Carlos Castaneda's The Second Ring of Power, Chapter 5, Part 2, The Art of Dreaming. She had changed the Western clothes she had been wearing the last time I had seen her, and had put on a long dress like the Indian woman of the area wore. She had a shawl on her shoulders and was barefoot. Her long dress, instead of making her look older and heavier, made her look like a child clad in an older woman's clothes. She walked up to the table, greeted LaGorda with a formal, "Good evening, Gorda," and then turned to me and said, "Good evening, Nawa." Her greeting was so unexpected and her tone so serious that I was about to laugh. I caught a warning from LaGorda. She pretended to be scratching the top of her head with the back of her left hand, which was clawed. I answered Lydia the same way LaGorda had. "Good evening to you, Lydia." She sat down at the end of the table to the right of me. I did not know whether or not to start up the conversation. I was about to say something when LaGorda tapped my leg with her knee and with a subtle movement of her eyebrows signaled me to listen. I heard again the muffled sound of a long dress as it touched the floor. Josefina stood for a moment at the door before walking toward the table. She greeted Lydia, LaGorda, and myself in that order. I could not keep a straight face with her. She was also wearing a long dress, a shawl, and no shoes. But in her case, the dress was 3 to 4 sizes larger, and she had put a thick padding into it. Her appearance was thoroughly incongruous. Her face was lean and young, but her body looked grotesquely bloated. She took a bench and placed it at the end of the table and sat down. All three of them looked extremely serious. They were sitting with their legs pressed together and their backs very straight. I heard one more rustle of a dress and Rosa came out. She was dressed like the others and was also barefoot. Her greeting was as formal and order naturally included Josefina. Everyone answered her in the same formal tone. She sat across the table facing me. All of us remained in absolute silence for quite a while. LaGorda spoke suddenly, and the sound of her voice made everyone else jump. She said, pointing to me, that the Nawal was going to show them his allies, and that he was going to use his special call to bring them into the room. I tried to make a joke and said that the Nawal was not there, so we could not bring any allies. I thought they were going to laugh. LaGorda covered her face and the little sisters glared at me. LaGorda put her hand on my mouth and whispered in my ear that it was absolutely necessary that I refrain from saying idiotic things. She looked right in my eyes and said that I had to call the allies by making the moth's call. I reluctantly began, but no sooner had I started than the spirit of the occasion took over, and I found that in a matter of seconds I had given my maximum concentration to producing the sound. I modulated its outflow and controlled the air being expelled from my lungs in order to produce the longest possible tapping. It sounded very melodious. I took an enormous gasp of air to start a new series. I stopped immediately. Something outside the house was answering my call. The tapping sound came from all around the house, even from the roof. The little sisters stood up and huddled like frightened children around LaGorda and myself. "All right, Monk, cut it out, will you? Monk!" "Please, Nawal, don't bring anything into the house," Lydia pleaded with me. Even LaGorda seemed to be frightened. She gave me a strong command with her hand to stop. I had not intended to keep on producing the sound anyway. The allies, however, either as formless forces or as beings that were prowling outside the door, were not dependent on my tapping sound. I felt again, as I had felt 2 nights before in Don Juan's house, an unbearable pressure, a heaviness leaning against the entire house. I could sense it in my navel as an itch, a nervousness that soon turned into sheer physical anguish. The three little sisters were beside themselves with fear, especially Lydia and Josephina. Both of them were whining like wounded dogs. All of them surrounded me and clung to me. Rosa crawled under the table and pushed her head up between my legs. Lagorda stood behind me as calmly as she could. After a few moments of the hysteria and fear of those three girls mounted to an enormous proportions, Lagorda leaned over and whispered that I should make the opposite sound, the sound that would disperse them. I had a moment of supreme uncertainty. I really did not know any other sound, but then I had a quick sensation of ticklishness on the top of my head, a shiver in my body, and I remembered out of nowhere a peculiar whistling that Don Juan used to perform at night and had endeavored to teach me. He had presented it to me as a means to keep one's balance while walking so as not to stray away from the trail in darkness. I began my whistling and the pressure in my umbilical region ceased. Lagorda smiled and sighed with relief, and the little sisters moved away from my side, giggling as if all of them, if it all had been merely a joke. I wanted to indulge in some soul-searching deliberations about the abrupt transition from the rather pleasant exchange I was having with Lagorda to that unearthly situation. For an instant, I pondered over whether or not the whole thing was a ploy on their part, but I was too weak. I felt I was about to pass out. My ears were buzzing. The tension around my stomach was so intense that I believed I was going to become ill right there. I rested my head on the edge of the table. After a few minutes, however, I was again relaxed enough to sit up straight. The three girls seemed to have forgotten about how frightened they had been. In fact, they were laughing and pushing each other as they tied their shawls around their hips. Lagorda did not seem nervous, nor did she seem relaxed. Rosa pushed me at one moment, was pushed at one moment by the other two, and fell off the bench where all three of them were sitting. She landed on her seat. I thought that she was going to get furious, but she giggled. I looked at Lagorda for directions. She was sitting with a very straight back. Her eyes were half closed, fixed on Rosa. The little sisters were laughing loudly, like nervous schoolgirls. Lydia pushed Josephina and sent her tumbling over the bench to fall next to Rosa on the floor. The instant Josephina was on the floor, their laughter stopped. Rosa and Josephina shook their bodies, making an incomprehensible movement with their buttocks. They moved them from side to side as if they were grinding something against the floor. Then they sprang up like two silent jaguars and took Lydia by the arms. All three of them, without making the slightest noise, spun around a couple of times. Rosa and Josephina lifted Lydia by the armpits and carried her as they tiptoed two or three times around the table. Then all three of them collapsed as if they had springs on their knees that had contracted at the same time. Their long dresses puffed up, giving them the appearance of huge balls. As soon as they were on the floor, they became even more quiet. There was no other sound except the soft swishing of their dresses as they rolled and crawled. It was as if they were watching a three-dimensional movie with the sound turned off. Lagorda, who had been quietly sitting next to me watching them, suddenly stood up with the agility of an acrobat, ran toward the door of their room at the corner of the dining room. Before she reached the door, she tumbled on her right side and shoulder just enough to turn over once, then stood up, pulled by the momentum of her rolling, and flung open the door. She performed all her movements with absolute quietness. The three girls rolled and crawled into the room like giant pill bugs. Lagorda signaled me to come over to where she was. We entered the room, and she had me sit on the floor with my back against the frame of the door. She sat to my right with her back also against the frame. She made me interlock my fingers and then place my hands over my belly button. The three girls rolled and crawled into the room like I was at first forced to divide my attention between Lagorda, the little sisters, and the room. But once Lagorda had arranged my sitting position, my attention was taken up by the room. The three girls were lying in the middle of a large, white, square room with a brick floor. There were four gasoline lanterns, one on each wall, placed on built-in support ledges, approximately 6 feet above the ground. The room had no ceiling. The support beams of the roof had been darkened, and that gave the effect of an enormous room with no top. The two doors were placed on the very corners opposite each other. As I looked at the closed door across from where I was, I noticed that the walls of the room were orientated to follow the cardinal points. The door where we were was at the northwest corner. Rosa, Lydia, and Josephina rolled counterclockwise around the room several times. I strained to hear the swish of their dresses, but the silence was absolute. I could only hear Lagorda breathing. The little sisters finally stopped and sat down with their backs against the wall, each under a lantern. Lydia sat at the east wall, Rosa at the north, and Josephina at the west. Lagorda stood up, closed the door behind us, and secured it with an iron bar. She made me slide over a few inches without changing my position, until I was sitting with my back against the door. Then she slightly rolled the length of the room and sat down underneath the lantern on the south wall. Her getting into that sitting position seemed to be the cue. Lydia stood up and began to walk on the tips of her toes along the edges of the room, close to the walls. It was not a walk proper, but rather a soundless sliding. As she increased her speed, she began to move as if she were gliding, stepping on the angle between the floor and the walls. She would jump over Rosa, Josephina, Lagorda, and myself every time she got to where we were sitting. I felt her long dress brushing me every time she went by. The faster she ran, the higher she got on the wall. A moment came when Lydia was actually running silently around the four walls of the room, 7 or 8 feet above the floor. The sight of her running perpendicular to the walls was so unearthly that it bordered on the grotesque. Her long gown made the sight even more eerie. Gravity did not seem to have any effect on Lydia, but it did on the long skirt. It dragged downward. I felt it every time she passed over my head, sweeping my face like a hanging drape. She had captured my attentiveness at a level I could not imagine. The strain of giving her my undivided attention was so great that I began to get stomach convulsions. I felt her running in my stomach. My eyes were getting out of focus. With the last bit of my remaining concentration, I saw Lydia walk down on the east wall diagonally and come to a halt in the middle of the room. She was panting, out of breath, and drenched in perspiration, like Lagorda had been after her flying display. She could barely keep her balance. After a moment, she walked to her place at the east wall and collapsed on the floor like a wet rag. I thought she had fainted, but then I noticed she was deliberately breathing through her mouth. After some minutes of stillness, long enough for Lydia to recover her strength and sit up straight, Rosa stood up and ran without making a sound to the center of the room, turned on her heels, and ran back to where she had been sitting. Her running allowed her to gain the necessary momentum to make an outlandish jump. She leaped up in the air like a basketball player along the vertical span of the wall. Her hands went beyond the height of the wall, which was perhaps 10 feet. I saw her body actually hitting the wall, although there was no corresponding crashing sound. I expected her to rebound to the floor with the force of the impact, but she remained hanging there, attached to the wall like a pendulum. From where I sat, it looked as if she were holding a hook of some sort in her left hand. She swayed silently in a pendulum-like motion for a moment, then capitulated herself 3 or 4 feet over to her left by pushing her body away from the wall with her right arm at the moment in which her swing was the widest. She repeated the swaying and capitulating 30 or 40 times. She went around the whole room, and then she went up to the beams of the roof, where she dangled precariously, hanging from an invisible hook. While she was on the beams, I became aware that what I had thought was a hook in her left hand was actually some quality of that hand that made it possible for her to suspend her weight from it. It was the same hand she had attacked me with the two nights before. Her display ended with her dangling from the beams over the very center of the room. Suddenly she let go. She fell down from a height of 15 or 16 feet. Her long dress flowed upward and gathered around her head. For an instant, before she landed without a sound, she looked like an umbrella turned inside out by the force of the wind. Her thin, naked body looked like a stick attached to the dark mass of her dress. My body felt the impact of her plummeting down, perhaps more than she did herself. She landed in a squat position and remained motionless, trying to catch her breath. I was sprawled out on the floor with painful cramps in my stomach. Lagorda rolled across the room, took her shawl and tied it around my umbilical region, like a band looping it around my body two or three times. She rolled back to the south wall like a shadow. While she had been arranging the shawl around my waist, I had lost sight of Rosa. When I looked up, she was again sitting against the north wall. A moment later, Josefina quietly moved to the center of the room. She paced back and forth with noiseless steps between where Lydia was sitting and her own spot at the west wall. She faced me all the time. Suddenly she approached her spot. She raised her left forearm and placed it right in front of her face, as if she wanted to block me from her view. She hid half of her face for an instant behind her forearm. She lowered it and raised it again, that time hiding her entire face. She repeated the movement of lowering and raising her left forearm countless times as she paced soundlessly from one side of the room to the other. Every time she raised her forearm, a bigger portion of her body disappeared from my view. A moment came when she had hidden her entire body, puffed up with clothes, behind her thin forearm. It was as if by blocking her view of my body sitting 10 to 12 feet away from her, a thing she could have easily done with the width of her forearm, she had also made me block the view of her body, a thing which could not possibly be done with just the width of her forearm. Once she had hidden her entire body, all I was able to make out was a silhouette of a forearm suspended in midair, bouncing from one side of the room to the other, and at one point I could hardly see the arm itself. I felt a revulsion, an unbearable nausea. The bouncing forearm depleted my energy. I slid down on my side, unable to keep my balance. I saw the arm falling to the ground. Josefina was lying on the floor, covered with garments, as if her puffed up clothes had exploded. She lay on her back with her arms spread out. It took a while to get back my physical balance. My clothes were soaked in perspiration. I was not the only one affected. All of them were exhausted and drenched in sweat. Lagorda was the most poised, but her control seemed to be on the verge of collapsing. I could hear all of them, including Lagorda, breathing through their mouths. When I was in full control again, everybody sat on her spot. The little sisters were looking at me fixedly. I saw out of the corner of my eye that Lagorda's eyes were half closed. She suddenly rolled noiselessly to my side and whispered in my ear that I should begin to make my moth call again, keeping it up until the allies had rushed into the house and were about to take us. I had a moment's facilitation. She whispered that there was no way to change directions, that we had to finish what we had started. After untying her shawl from my waist, she rolled back to her spot and sat down. I put my left hand to my lips and tried to produce the tapping sound. I found it very difficult at first. My lips were dry and my hands were sweaty, but after the initial clumsiness, a feeling of vigor and well-being came over me. I produced the most flawless tapping noise I had ever done. It reminded me of the tapping noise I had been hearing all along as a response to mine. As soon as I stopped to breathe, I could hear the tapping sound being answered from all directions. Lagorda signaled me to go on with it. I produced three more series. The last one was utterly mesmeric. I did not need to intake a gulp of air and let it out in small spurts, as I had been doing all along. This time the tapping sound came out of my mouth freely. I did not even have to use the edge of my hand to produce it. Lagorda suddenly rushed to me, lifted me up bodily by my armpits, and pushed me to the middle of the room. Her action disrupted my absolute concentration. I noticed that Lydia was holding on to my right arm, Josephina to my left, and Rosa had backed up against the wall, front of me, and was holding me by the waist, with her arms extended backward. Lagorda was in back of me. She ordered me to put my arms behind and grab onto her shawl, which she had looped around her neck and shoulders like a harness. I noticed at that moment that something besides us was there in the room, and I could not tell what it was. The little sisters were shivering. I knew that they were aware of something which I was unable to distinguish. I also knew that Lagorda was going to try to do what she had done in Don Gennaro's house. All of a sudden, I felt the wind of the eye door pulling us. I grabbed onto Lagorda's shawl with all my strength while the little sisters grabbed onto me. I felt that we were spinning, tumbling, swaying from side to side like a giant weightless leaf. I opened my eyes and saw that we were like a bundle. We were either standing up or we were lying horizontally in the air. I could not tell which because I had no sensorial point of reference. Then, as suddenly as we had been lifted off, we were dropped. I sensed our falling in my midsection. I yelled with pain and my screams were united with those of the little sisters. The insides of my knees hurt. I felt an unbearable jolt on my legs. I thought I must have broken them. My next impression was that something was getting inside my nose. It was very dark and I was lying on my back. I sat up. I realized then that Lagorda was tickling my nostrils with a twig. I did not feel exhausted or even mildly tired. I jumped to my feet and only then was I stricken by the realization that we were not in the house. We were on a hill, a rocky, barren hill. I took a step and nearly fell down. I had stumbled over a body. It was Josephina. She was extremely hot to the touch. She seemed to be feverish. I tried to make her sit up, but she was limp. Rosa was next to her. As a contrast, her body was icy cold. I put one on top of the other and rocked them. That motion brought them back to their senses. Lagorda had found Lydia and was making her walk. After a few minutes, all of us were standing. We were perhaps a half a mile east of the house. Years before, Don Juan had produced in me a similar experience, but with the aid of psychotropic plant. He seemingly made me fly, and I landed a distance from his house. At the time, I had tried to explain the event in rational terms, but there was no ground for rational explanation. And short of accepting that I had flown, I had to fall back onto the only two avenues left open. I could explain it all by arguing that Don Juan had transported me to the distant field while I was still unconscious under the effect of the psychotropic alkaloids of the plant, or by arguing that under the influence of the alkaloids, I had believed what Don Juan was ordering me to believe, that I was flying. This time I had no other recourse but to brace myself for accepting on its face value that I had flown. I wanted to indulge in doubts and began to wonder about the possibilities of the four girls carrying me to that hill. I laughed loudly, incapable of containing an obscure delight. I was having a relapse of my old malady. My reason, which had been blocked off temporarily, was beginning to take hold of me again. I wanted to defend it. Or perhaps it would be more appropriate to say, in light of the outlandish acts I had witnessed and performed since my arrival, that my reason was defending itself, independently of the more complex whole that seemed to be the me I did not know. I was witnessing, almost in the fashion of an interested observer, how my reason struggled to find suitable rationales, while another, much larger portion of me could not have cared less about explaining anything. LaGuardia made the three girls line up. She then pulled me to her side. All of them folded their arms behind their backs. LaGuardia made me do the same. She stretched my arms as far back as they would go, and then made me bend them and grab each forearm as tightly as possible, as close to the elbows as I could. That created a great muscular pressure at the articulations of my shoulder. Articulations of my, I don't know what that is. She pushed my trunk forward until I was almost stooping. Then she made a peculiar bird call. That was a signal. Lydia started walking. In the darkness, her movements remained of an ice skater. She walked swiftly and silently, and in a few minutes, she disappeared from view. LaGuardia made two more bird calls, one after the other. Rosa and Josefina took off in the same manner Lydia had. LaGuardia told me to follow close to her. She made one more bird call, and we both started walking. I was surprised at the ease with which I had walked. My entire balance was centered in my legs. The fact that I had my arms behind my back instead of hindering my movements aided me in maintaining a strange equilibrium. But above all, what surprised me the most was the quietness of my steps. When we reached the road, we began to walk normally. We passed two men going in the opposite direction. LaGuardia greeted them, and they answered back. When we arrived at the house, we found the little sisters standing by the door. Not daring to go in, LaGuardia told them that although I could not control the allies, I could either call them or tell them to leave, and that the allies would not bother us any longer. The girls believed her, something I myself could not do in that instance. We went inside in a very quiet and efficient manner. All of them undressed, drenched themselves with cold water, and put on a fresh change of clothes. I did the same. I put on the old clothes I used to keep in Don Juan's house, which LaGuardia had brought me in a box. All of us were in high spirits. I asked LaGuardia to explain to me what we had done. "We'll talk about that later," she said in a firm tone. I remembered then that the packages I had had for them were still in the car. I thought that while LaGuardia was cooking some food for us, it would be a good opportunity to distribute them. I went out and got them and brought them into the house. I placed them on the table. Lydia asked me if I had already assigned the gifts, as she had suggested. I said that I wanted them to pick one they liked. She declined. She said that no doubt I had something special for Pablito and Nesta, and a bunch of trinkets for them, which I would throw on the table with the intention that they fight over them. "Besides, you didn't bring anything for Benigno," Lydia said as she came to my side and looked at me with mock seriousness. "You can't hurt the Gennaro's feelings by giving two of them two gifts for three." They all laughed. I felt embarrassed. They all laughed. I felt embarrassed. She was absolutely right in everything she had said. "You are careless. That's why I never like you," Lydia said to me, changing her smile into a frown. "You have never greeted me with affection or respect. Every time we saw each other, you only pretended to be happy to see me." She imitated my obviously contrived, effusive greetings, a greeting I must have given her countless times in the past. "Why didn't you ever ask me what I was doing here?" Lydia asked me. I stopped writing to consider her point. It had never occurred to me to ask her anything. I told her that I had no excuse. LaGuardia interceded and said that the reason I had never said more than two words to either Lydia or Rosa each time I saw them was because I was accustomed to talking only to women that I was enamored of, and in one way or another. LaGuardia added that the Nawal had told them that if I would ask them anything directly, they were supposed to answer my question. but as long as I did not ask, they were not supposed to mention anything. Rosa said that she did not like me because I was always laughing and trying to be funny. Josephina added that since I had never seen her, she just liked me just for fun, for the hell of it. I want you to know that I don't accept you as the Nawal, Lydia said to me. You're too dumb. You know nothing. You know I know more than you do. How can I respect you? Lydia added that as far as she was concerned, I could go back to where I came from, or go jump in a lake, for that matter. Rosa and Josephina did not say a word. Judging by the seriousness and mean expressions on their faces, however, they seemed to agree with Lydia. How can this man leave us? Lydia asked Lagorda. He's not a true Nawal. He's a man. He's going to make us into idiots like himself. As she was talking, I could see the mean expression on Rosa's face and Josephina's faces getting even harder. Lagorda intervened and explained to them what she had seen earlier about me. She added that since she had recommended to me not to get entangled in their webs, she was recommending the same thing to them, not to get entangled in mine. After Lydia initially display of genuine and well-founded animosity, I was flabbergasted to see how easily she acquiesced to Lagorda's remarks. She smiled at me and even came and sat next to me. You really like us, as she said in a tone of bewilderment. I didn't know what to say. I was afraid of blundering. Lydia was obviously the leader of the little sisters. The moment she smiled at me, the other two seemed to be infused instantly with the same mood. Lagorda told them not to mind my pencil and paper and my asking questions, that in return I would not be flustered when they became involved in doing what they loved the most, to indulge in themselves. The three of them sat close to me. Lagorda walked over to the table, got the packages, and took them out to my car. I asked Lydia to forgive me for my inexcusable blunderings of the past and asked all of them to tell me how they had become Don Juan's apprentices. In order to make them feel at ease, I gave them an account of how I had met Don Juan. Their accounts were the same as what Donna Soledad had already told me. Lydia said that all of them had been free to leave Don Juan's world, but their choice had been to stay. She, in particular, being the first apprentice, was given an opportunity to go away. After the Nawal and Janeiro had cured her, the Nawal had pointed to the door and told her that if she did not go through it then, the door would close her in and would never open again. Her fate was sealed when the door closed, Lydia said to me. Just like what happened to you. The Nawal told me that after he had put a patch on you, you had a chance to leave, but you didn't want to take it. I remembered that particular decision more vividly than anything else. I recounted to them how Don Juan had tricked me into believing that a sorceress was after me, and then he gave me the choice of either leaving for good or staying to help him wage a war against his attacker. It turned out that his alleged attacker was one of his confederates. By confronting her on what I thought was Don Juan's behalf, I turned her against me, and she became what he called my worthy opponent. I asked Lydia if they had a worthy opponent themselves. We are not as dumb as you are, she said. We never needed anyone to spur us. Pablito is that dumb, Rosa said. Soledad is his opponent. I don't know how worthy she is, though. But as the saying goes, if you can't feed on a capon, feed on an onion. This is an obscure one, huh? They laughed and banged on the table. I asked them if any of them knew the sorceress Don Juan had pitted against me, La Catalina. They shook their heads negatively. I know her, Lagorda said from the stove. She's from Don Juan's cycle, but she looks as if she's 30. What is a cycle, I asked. She walked over to the table and put her foot on the bench and rested her chin on her arm and knee. Sorcerers like the Nawal and Janeiro have two cycles. The first is when they're human, like ourselves. We are in our first cycle. Each of us has been given a task and that task is making us leave the human form. Elysio, the five of us, and the Gennaros are of the same cycle. The second cycle is when a sorcerer is not human anymore, like the Narwhal and Gennaro. They came to teach us, and after they taught us, they left. We are the second cycle to them. The Narwhal and La Catalina are like you and Lydia. They are in the same positions. She's a scary sorceress, just like Lydia. Magordia went back to the stove. The little sisters seemed nervous. That must be the woman who knows power plants, Lydia said to Lagorda. Lagorda said that was the one. I asked them if the Narwhal had ever given them power plants. No, not to us three, Lydia replied. Power plants are given only to empty people, like yourself and Lagorda. Did the Narwhal give you power plants, Gorda? I asked loudly. Lagorda raised two fingers over her head. The Narwhal gave me his pipe twice, Lydia said. The Narwhal gave her his pipe twice, Lydia said. And she went off her rocker both times. What happened, Gorda? I asked. She went off her rocker, she said as she walked over to the table. Power plants were given to us because the Narwhal was putting a patch on our bodies. Mayan hooked fast, but yours was difficult. The Narwhal said that you were crazier than Josephina and impossible like Lydia, and he had to give you a lot of them. Lagorda explained that power plants were used only by sorcerers who had mastered their art. Those plants were such a powerful affair that in order to be properly handled, the most impeccable attention was needed on the part of the sorcerer. It took a lifetime to train one's attention to the degree needed. Lagorda said that complete people do not need power plants, that neither the little sisters nor the Gennaros had ever taken them. Excuse me. But that someday, when they had perfected their art as dreamers, they would use them to get a final total boost, a boost of such a magnitude that it would be impossible for us to understand. Would you and I take them too? I asked Lagorda. All of us, she replied. Though Narwhal said that you should understand this point better than any of us. I considered the issue for a moment. The effect of psychotropic plants had indeed been terrifying for me. They seemed to reach a vast reservoir in me and extract from it a total world. The drawback in taking them had been the toll they took on my physical well-being and the impossibility of controlling their effect. The world they plunged me into was unamenable and chaotic. I lacked the control, the power, in Don Juan's terms, to make use of such a world. If I would have the control, however, the possibilities would be staggering to the mind. I took them myself, Josephina said all of a sudden. When I was crazy, the Narwhal gave me his pipe to cure me or kill me, and it cured me. The Narwhal really gave Josephina his smoke, Lagorda said from the stove, and then came over to the table. He knew that she was pretending to be crazier than she was. She has always been a bit off, and she's very daring and indulges herself like no one else. She always wanted to live where nobody would bother her, and she could do whatever she wanted. So the Narwhal gave her his smoke and took her to live in the world of her liking for 14 days, until she was so bored with it that she got cured. She cut her indulging. That was her cure. Lagorda went back to the stove. The little sisters laughed and patted one another on the back. I remembered then that at Donna Soldad's house, Lydia had not intimated that Don Juan had left a package for me, but she had actually shown me a bundle that had made me think of the sheath in which Don Juan used to keep his pipe. I reminded Lydia that she had said she would give me that package when Lagorda was present. The little sisters looked at one another and then turned to LaGuardia. She made a gesture with her head. Josephina stood up and went into the front room. She returned for a moment later with the bundle that Lydia had shown me. I had a pang of anticipation in the pit of my stomach. Josephina carefully placed the bundle on the table in front of me. All of them gathered around. She began to untie it as ceremoniously as Lydia had done the first time. When the package was completely unwrapped, she spilled the contents on the table. They were menstrual rags. I got flustered for an instant, but the sound of LaGuardia's laughter, which was louder than the others, was so pleasing I had to laugh myself. "That's Josephina's personal bundle, LaGuardia said. "It was her brilliant idea to play on your greed for a gift from the Nawal in order to make you stay." "You have to admit that it was a good idea," Lydia said to me. She imitated the look of greed I had on my face while she was opening the package, and then my look of disappointment when she did not finish. I told Josephina that her idea had indeed been brilliant, that it had worked as she had anticipated, and that I wanted that package more than I would care to admit. "You can have it if you want it," Josephina said, and made everyone laugh. LaGuardia said that the Nawal had known from the beginning that Josephina was not really ill, and that that was the reason it had been so difficult for him to cure her. "People who are actually sick are more pliable. Josephina was too aware of everything and very unruly, and he had to smoke her a great many times." Don Juan had once said the same thing about me, that he had smoked me. I had always believed that he was referring to the use of psychotropic mushrooms to have a view of me. How did he smoke you?" I asked Josephina. She shrugged her shoulders and did not answer. "The same way he smoked you," Lydia said. "He pulled your luminosity and dried it with the smoke from a fire that he had made." I was sure that Don Juan had never explained such a thing to me. I asked Lydia to tell me what she knew about the subject. She turned to LaGuardia. "Smoke is very important for sorcerers," LaGuardia said. "Smoke is like fog. Fog is, of course, better, but it's too hard to handle. It's not as handy as smoke is. So if a sorcerer wants to see and know someone who is always hiding, like you and Josephina, who are capricious and difficult, the sorcerer makes a fire and lets the smoke envelop the person. Whatever they're hiding comes out in the smoke." LaGuardia said that the Nawal you smoke only to see and know people, but also to cure. He gave Josephina smoke baths. He made her stand or sit by the fire in the direction the wind was blowing. The smoke would envelop her and make her choke and cry, but her discomfort was only temporary and of no consequence. The positive effects, on the other hand, were a gradual cleansing of the luminosity. "The Nawal gave us, all of us, smoke baths," LaGuardia said. "He gave you even more baths than Josephina. He said you were unbearable, and you were not even pretending like she was." It all became clear to me. She was right. Don Juan had made me sit in front of the fire hundreds of times. The smoke used to irritate my throat and eyes to such a degree that I dreaded to see him begin to see him gather dry twigs and branches. He said that I had to learn to control my breathing and feel the smoke while I kept my eyes closed. That way I could breathe without choking. LaGuardia said that the smoke had helped Josephina to be ethereal and very elusive, and that no doubt it had helped me to cure my madness, whatever it was. "The Nawal said that smoke takes everything out of you," LaGuardia went on. "It makes you clear and direct." I asked her if she knew how to bring out with the smoke whatever a person was hiding. She said that she could easily do it because of having lost her form, but that the little sisters in Gennaro's, although they had seen the Nawal and Gennaro do it scores of times, could not yet do it themselves. I was curious to know how Don Juan had never mentioned the subject to me, in spite of the fact that he had smoked me like dry fish hundreds of times. He did, LaGuardia said, with her usual conviction. The Narwhal even taught you fog gazing. He told us that once you smoked a whole place in the mountains, he told us that once you smoked a whole place in the mountains and saw what was hiding behind the scenery, he said that he was spellbound himself. I remembered an exquisite perceptual distortion, a hallucination of sorts, which I had had and thought was the product of a play between a most dense fog and an electrical storm that was occurring at the time. I narrated to them the episode and added that Don Juan had never really directly taught me anything about the fog or the smoke. His procedure had been to build fires or to take me to fog banks. LaGuardia did not say a word. She stood up and went back to the stove. Lydia shook her head and clicked her tongue. You sure are dumb, she said. The Narwhal taught you everything. How do you think you saw what you just told us about? There was an abyss between our understanding of how to teach something. I told them that if I were to teach them something I knew, such as how to drive a car, I would go step by step, making sure they understood every facet of the whole procedure. LaGuardia returned to the table. That's only if the sorcerer is teaching something about the tonal, she said. When the sorcerer teaches dealing with the Narwhal, he must give the instruction, which is to show the mystery to the warrior. And that's all he has to do. The warrior who receives the mysteries must claim the knowledge as power by doing what he has been shown. The Narwhal showed you more mysteries than all of us put together. But you're lazy, like Pablito, and prefer to be confused. The tonal and the Narwhal are two different worlds. In one you talk, in the other you act. At the moment she spoke, her words made absolute sense to me. I knew what she was talking about. She went back to the stove, stirred something in a pot, and came back again. Why are you so dumb? Lydia asked me. He's empty, Rosa replied. They made me stand up and force themselves to squint as they scanned my body with their eyes. All of them touched my umbilical region. But why are you still empty? Lydia said. You know what to do, don't you? Rosa added. He was crazy, Josephina said to them. He must still be crazy now. LaGuardia came to my aid and told them that I was still empty for the same reason they still had their form. All of us secretly did not want the world of the Narwhal. We were afraid and had second thoughts. In short, none of us was any better than Pablito. They did not say a word. All three of them seemed thoroughly embarrassed. Poor little Narwhal, Lydia said to me with a tone of genuine concern. You are as scared as we are. I pretend to be tough. Josephina pretends to be crazy. Rosa pretends to be ill-tempered. And you pretend to be dumb. They laughed, and for the first time since I had arrived, they made a gesture of comradeship toward me. They embraced me and put their heads against mine. LaGuardia, still facing me, with the little sisters sat around, as the little sisters sat around her, I was facing all four of them. Now we can talk about what happened tonight, LaGuardia said. The Narwhal told me, if we survived the last contact with the Allies, we wouldn't be the same. The Allies did something to us tonight. They have hurled us away. She gently touched my writing hand. Tonight was a special night for you, she went on. Tonight, all of us pitched in to help you, including the Allies. The Narwhal would have liked it. Tonight you saw all the way through. I did, I asked. There you go again, Lydia said, and everybody laughed. Tell me about seeing, Gorder, I insisted. You know that I am dumb. There should be no misunderstandings between us. All right, she said. I see what you mean. Tonight you saw the little sisters. I said to them that I had also witnessed incredible acts performed by Don Juan and Don Gennaro. I had seen them as plainly as I had seen the Little Sisters, and yet Don Juan and Don Gennaro had always concluded that I had not seen. I failed, therefore, to determine in what way could the acts of the Little Sisters be different. You mean you didn't see how they were holding onto the lines of the worlds, she asked. No, I didn't. You didn't see them slipping through the crack between the worlds? I narrated to them what I had witnessed. They listened in silence. At the end of my account, Lagorda seemed to be on the verge of tears. What a pity, she exclaimed. She stood up and walked around the table and embraced me. Her eyes were clear and restful. I knew she bore no malice toward me. It is our fate that you are plugged up like this, she said. But you're still the Nahual to us. I won't hinder you with ugly thoughts. You can at least be assured of that. I knew that she meant it. She was speaking to me from a level that I had witnessed only in Don Juan. She had repeatedly explained her mood as the product of having lost her human form. She was indeed a formless warrior. A wave of profound affection for her enveloped me. I was about to weep. It was at that instant that I felt she was a most marvelous warrior, that quite an intriguing thing happened to me. The closest way of describing it would be to say that I felt that my ears had suddenly popped, except that I felt the popping in the middle of my body, right below my navel, more acutely than in my ears. Right after the popping, something became clearer, sounds, sights, odors. Then I felt an intense buzzing, which oddly enough did not interfere with my hearing capacity. The buzzing was loud, but did not drown out any other sounds. It was as if I were hearing the buzzing with some part of me other than my ears. A hot flash went through my body, and then I suddenly recalled something I had never seen. It was as though an alien memory had taken possession of me. I remembered Lydia pulling herself from two horizontal reddish ropes as she walked on the wall. She was not really walking. She was actually gliding on a thick bundle of lines that she held with her feet. I remembered seeing her panting with her mouth open from the exertion of pulling the reddish ropes. The reason I could not hold my balance at the end of her display was because I was seeing her as a light that went through the room so fast that it made me dizzy. It pulled on me from the area around my navel. I remembered Rosa's actions and Josephina's as well. Rosa had actually braconated with her left arm looking onto long vertical reddish fibers that looked like vines dropping from the dark roof. With her right arm, she also was also holding some vertical fibers that seemed to give her stability. She also held on to the same fibers with her toes. Toward the end of her display, she was like a phosphorescence on the floor. The lines of her body had been erased. Josephina was hiding herself behind some lines that seemed to come out of the floor. What she was doing with her raised forearm was moving the lines together to give them the necessary width to conceal her bulk. Her puffed-up clothes were a great prop. They had somehow contracted her luminosity. The clothes were bulky only for the eye that looked. At the end of her display, Josephina, like Lydia and Rosa, was just a patch of light. I could switch from one recollection to the other in my mind. When I told them about my concurrent memories, the Little Sisters looked at me bewildered. Lagorda was the only one who seemed to be following what was happening to me. She laughed with true delight and said that the Nahual was right in saying that I was too lazy to remember what I had seen. Therefore, I only bothered with what I had looked at. It is possible, I thought to myself, that I have consciously selected, is it possible I have unconsciously selected what I recall? Or is it Or is it LaGuardia who is, or is it LaGuardia who is creating all this? If it was true, I had selected my recall at first, and then realized I had censored what I had. If it was true that I had selected my recall at first and then released what I had censored, then it was also had to be true that I must perceive much more of Don Juan and Don Gennaro's action. Yet I could only recall a selective part of my perception of those events. "It's hard to believe," I said to LaGuardia, "that I can remember now something I didn't remember at all a while ago." The narwhal said that everyone can see, and yet we choose not to remember what we see, she said. Now I understand how right he was. All of us can see, some more than others. I told LaGuardia that some part of me knew what I had found then, a transcendental key, a missing piece that had been handed down to me by all of them, but it was difficult to discern what it was. She announced that she had just seen that I had had practiced a good deal of dreaming, and that I had developed my attention, and yet I was fooled by my own appearance of not knowing anything. "I've been trying to tell you about attention," she said, "but you know as much about it, but you know as much as we do about it." She assured me that my knowledge was intrinsically different from theirs. Theirs was infinitely more spectacular than mine. Anything they might say to me in relation to their practices, therefore, was a bonus to me. The narwhal told us to show you that with our attention we can hold the images of a dream in the same way we hold the images of the world, LaGuardia said. The art of the dreamer is the art of attention. Thoughts came down on me like a landslide. I had to stand up and walk around the room. I sat down again. We remained quiet for a while. I knew what she had meant when she said that the art of the dreamers was the art of attention. I knew then that Don Juan had told me and showed me everything he could. I had not been able, however, to realize the premises of his knowledge in my body while he was around. He had said that my reason was the demon that kept me chained, and that I had to vanquish it if I wanted to achieve the realization of his teachings. The issue, therefore, had been how to vanquish my reason. It had never occurred to me to press him for a definition of what he meant by reason. I presumed all along that he meant the capacity for comprehending, and fearing, or thinking in an orderly, rational way. From what LaGuardia had said, I knew that to him, reason meant attention. Don Juan said that the core of our being was the act of perceiving, and that the magic of our being was the act of awareness. For him, perception and awareness were a single, functional, inextricable unit, a unit which had two domains. The first one was the attention of the tonal, that is to say, the capacity of the average people to perceive and place their awareness on the ordinary world of everyday life. Don Juan called this form of attention the first ring of power, and described it as our awesome but taken for granted ability to impart order to our perception of the daily world. The second domain was the attention of the narwhal, that is to say, the capacity of sorcerers to place their awareness on the non-ordinary world. He called this domain of attention the second ring of power. The altogether pretentious ability that all of us have, but only sorcerers use, to impart order to the non-ordinary world. LaGuardia and the Little Sisters, in demonstrating to me the art of dreamers, was to hold the images of their dreams with their attention, had brought in in the pragmatic aspect of Don Juan's scheme. They were the practitioners who had gone beyond the theoretical aspect of his teachings. In order to give me a demonstration of that art, they had to make use of their second ring of power, or the attention of the Nawa. In order for me to witness their art, I had to do the same. In fact, it was evident that I had placed my attention on both domains. Perhaps all of us are continually perceiving in both fashions, but choose to isolate one for recollection and discard the other, or perhaps we file it away, as I myself had done. Under certain conditions of stress or acquiescence, the sensed memory surfaces, and we can then have two distinct memories of one event. What Don Juan had struggled to vanquish, or rather suppress in me, was not my reason as the capacity for rational thought, but my attention of the tonal, or my awareness of the world of common sense. His motive for wanting me to do so was explained by Lagorda when she said that the daily world exists because we know how to hold its images. Consequently, if one drops the attention needed to maintain those images, the world collapses. The Nawal told us that practice is what counts, Lagorda said suddenly. Once you get your attention on the images of your dream, your attention is hooked for good. In the end, you can be like Gennaro, who could hold the images of any dream. We each have five other dreams, Lydia said, but we showed you the first one because that was the dream the Nawal gave us. Can you all go into dreaming at any time you want? I asked. No, Lagorda replied. Dreaming takes too much power. None of us has that much power. The reason the little sisters had to roll on the floor so many times was that in rolling, the earth was giving them energy. Maybe you could also remember seeing them as luminous beings getting energy from the light of the earth. The Nawal said that the best way of getting energy is, of course, to let the sun inside the eyes, especially the left eye. I told her that I knew nothing about it, and she described the procedure that Don Juan had taught them. As she spoke, I remember that Don Juan had also taught the same procedure to me. It consisted of moving my head slowly from side to side as I caught the sunlight with my half-closed left eye. He said that one could not only use the sun, but could use any kind of light that could shine on the eyes. Lagorda said that the Nawal had recommended that they tie their shawls below their waist in order to protect their hip bones when they rolled. I commented that Don Juan had never mentioned rolling to me. She said that only women could roll because they had wombs, and the energy came directly into their wombs. By rolling around, they distributed the energy over the rest of their bodies. In order for a man to be energized, he had to be on his back, with his knees bent so that the soles of his feet were touching each other. His arms had to be extended laterally, with his forearms raised vertically, and the fingers clawed in an upright position. We have been dreaming those dreams for years, Lydia said. Those dreams are our best, because our attention is complete. In the other dreams that we have, our attention is still shaky. Lagorda said that holding the images of dreams was a Toltec art. After years of consuming practice, each one of them was able to perform one act in any dream. Lydia could walk on anything. Rosa could dangle from anything. Josephina could hide behind anything. And she herself could fly. But they were only beginners, apprentices of the art. They had complete attention for only one activity. She added that Gennaro was the master of dreaming. He could turn the tables around and have attention for as many activities as we have in our daily life, and that for him, the two domains of attention had the same value. I felt compelled to ask them my usual question. I had to know their procedures, how they held the images of their dreams. You know that as well as we do, LaGuardia said. The only thing I can say is that after going to the same dream over and over, we began to feel the lines of the world. They helped us do what you saw us doing. Don Juan had said that our first ring of power is engaged very early in our lives, and that we live under the impression that that is all there is to us. Our second ring of power, the attention of the Nahual, remains hidden for the immense majority of us, and only at the moment of our death is it revealed to us. There was a pathway to reach it, however, which is available to every one of us, and which only sorcerers take, and that pathway is through dreaming. Dreaming was, in essence, the transformation of ordinary dreams into affairs involving volition. Dreamers, by engaging their attention of the Nahual and focusing it on the items and events of their ordinary dreams, change those dreams into dreaming. Don Juan said that there was no procedures to arrive at the attention of the Nahual. He only gave me pointers. Finding my hands in my dream was the first pointer. Then the exercise of paying attention was elongated to finding objects, looking for specific features such as buildings, streets, and so on. From there, the jump was to dreaming about specific places at specific times of day. The final stage was drawing the attention of the Nahual to focus on the total self. Don Juan said that that final stage was usually ushered in by a dream that many of us have had one time or another, in which one of us is looking at oneself sleeping in bed. By the time a sorcerer has had such a dream, his attention has been developed to such a degree that instead of waking himself up, as most of us would do in a similar situation, he turns on his heels and engages himself in activity, as if he were acting in the world of everyday life. From that moment on, there is a breakage, a division of sorts, in the otherwise unified personality. The result of engaging the attention of the Nahual and developing it to the height and sophistication of our daily attention of the world was, in Don Juan's scheme, the other self, an identical being as oneself, but made in dreaming. Don Juan had told me that there are no definite steps for teaching that double, as there are no definite steps for us to reach our daily awareness. We simply do it by practicing. He contended that in the act of engaging our attention of the Nahual, we would find the steps. He urged me to practice dreaming, and without letting my fears make it into an encumbering production. He had done the same with LaGuardia and the Little Sisters, but obviously something in them had made them more receptive to the idea of another level of attention. Gennaro was in his body of dreaming most of the time, LaGuardia said. He liked it better. That's why he could do the weirdest things and scare you half to death. Gennaro could go in and out of the crack between the worlds like you and I can go in and out of a door. Don Juan had also talked to me at great length about the crack between the worlds. I'd always believed that he was talking in a metaphorical sense about a subtle division between the world that the average man perceives and the world that sorcerers perceive. LaGuardia and the Little Sisters had shown me that the crack between the worlds was more than a metaphor. It was rather a capacity to change levels of attention. One part of me understood LaGuardia perfectly, while another part of me was more frightened than ever. You have been asking where the Nahual and Gennaro went, LaGuardia said. Soldar was very blunt and told you that they went to the other world. Lydia told you they left this area, and the Gennaros were stupid and scared you. The truth is, the Nahual and Gennaro went through that crack. For some reason, undefinable to me, her statements plunged me into profound chaos. I felt all along that they had left for good. I knew that they had not left in an ordinary sense, but I had kept that feeling in the realm of a metaphor, although I had even voiced it to my close friends. I think I never really believed it myself. In the depths of me, I had always been a rational man, but LaGuardia and the Little Sisters had turned my obscure metaphors into real possibilities. LaGuardia had actually transported us a half a mile with the energy of her dreaming. LaGuardia stood up and said that I had understood everything and that it was time for us to eat. She served us food that she had cooked. I did not feel like eating. At the end of the meal, she stood up and came to my side. "I think it's time for you to leave," she said to me. That seemed to be a cue for the Little Sisters. They also stood up. "If you stay beyond this moment, you won't be able to leave anymore," LaGuardia went on. "The Nawal gave you freedom once, but you chose to stay with him. He told me that if we all survived the last contact with the Allies, I should feed all of you, make you feel good, and they then say goodbye to all of you. I figure that the Little Sisters and myself have no place to go, so there is no choice for us. But you are different." The Little Sisters surrounded me, and each said goodbye to me. There was a monstrous irony in the situation. I was free to leave, but I had no place to go. There was no choice for me either. Years before, Don Juan gave me a chance to back out. I stayed, because already then, I had no place to go. "We choose only once," he had said then. "We choose either to be warriors or to be ordinary men. A second choice does not exist, not on this earth." End of chapter.